This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Osteothera plus Ipraflavone from Claire Labs. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus Ipraflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about one of the most common causes of death in America. And we haven't talked about this. It's surprising because we've focused on heart disease and we focused on cancer. And of course, those are two of the biggest reasons why the Grim Reaper takes a toll. But did you know that the third leading cause of death in America is preventable medical errors? Medical mistakes lead to as many as 440,000 preventable deaths every year. And today we're going to talk about it with the director, producer, and writer of a very, very groundbreaking documentary, To Err is Human. Mike Eisenberg is a documentary film producer. He's partner and creative director of Tall Tale Productions in Chicago, and he's directed a variety of films and commercials. And now he's turning his attention to the problem of medical errors. And it's a very, very compelling story that he tells in this 77-minute feature film. Welcome, Mike. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to talking.
Okay, it's my pleasure. So, you know, to put this in context, you know, I actually, this is a topic that, you know, we've been talking about literally for decades. And I remember early in my career, I was talking about it, I believe it was in the 1990s. And I said, there are so many medical errors in this country, and it just goes virtually unnoticed. I mean, if a plane crashes, it's a huge deal. And in fact, we've had a really sterling aviation history in the past year, only to be broken by the recent tragic crash in Cuba, with over 100 people died, I believe. So it's an anomaly. But it turns out that, and this is what I said in the 1990s, that the number of preventable deaths every year is the equivalent to crashing a fully loaded 747 plane every day. But rather starkly, the statistic has changed. Right? It's even worse than that.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of debate, I think, going on in the medical community about which numbers should be used as the consensus, but there is no real consensus. And I think when you look at all the different research that's happened over the last 15 to 20 years in this pretty new field of study, it started in the late 90s with a report from the National Academy of Medicine that at that time, it was the Institute of Medicine, that 44 to 98,000 people die every year from these preventable mistakes, medical errors. And and that was a shock to everybody. I mean, it blew people's minds and really kind of kickstarted a new generation of thinking differently about how quality of care should be perceived. And over these last 10 to 15 years, I think people have understood a little bit better what a preventable mistake is. And that's why the numbers go up. It's not necessarily that it's getting worse. It's that the actual methods of researching it are getting better. So where the debate lies is, well, in 2016, the most recent study, Johns Hopkins suggested it could be 251,000 was kind of their range or their number. And a couple of years before that, the one that we reference in the film is, you know, goes as high as 440,000. And that's a John James study that uses all the areas of healthcare, you know, through across the continuum and all the possible errors that could occur, from the obvious things like wrong site surgeries or horrific adverse events to the more mundane, less noticeable things like communication breakdowns or diagnostic errors. So there's just this huge gamut of ways that we can be impacted negatively while in the course of care. So actually finding a number is very difficult.
Well, to continue with this plane crash analogy, if we do the math on that, it's now 2.5 747s per day. You know, if we're going to do the, you know, the grim arithmetic on this. And so, you know, again, this is something where, you know, plane crash headlines, you know, major news stories on cable news for days, a terrible anomalous event. And yet, we almost have a complacency about these medical errors. Some doctors say, look, you know, it's not the same because you take a bunch of healthy people who are headed for, say, a vacation destination. They don't expect to die, and then they die tragically. It's out of the blue. But these people, you know, who are dying of the medical mishaps, they're sick. They're already vulnerable. You know, mistakes can be made. We're saving lives. This is the cost of doing business, so to speak, in, you know, in a high-risk industry.
Right. And we're all going to die at some point. I think that is universally agreed upon at this point. So it doesn't necessarily matter how you die as much as it matters whether or not you're dying in the way you should be dying. And by that, I mean, if you have cancer and the doctor tells you you have 12 months left to live, you shouldn't die in 6 months. If you're a healthy individual and you go to the hospital for a normal cut, some kind of, you need 15 stitches, you shouldn't leave with MRSA, with an infection that could cause you to get sepsis and die. I mean, these are the deaths that we're talking about are preventable. You know, there are things that happen in the course of care that shouldn't happen. There are bad doctors, they exist, that are doing awful things and harming patients intentionally, and they tend to get found out pretty quickly. But all these other doctors across the healthcare world are trying to do good, trying to help patients, and there are systemic issues that get in the way of that are really hard to notice and cause what we identify in the film as the Swiss cheese effect. And little mistakes that eventually reach the patient because they go through these small gaps in care. And what we should all be working hard to do, and we is the medical community. I'm not actually in the medical community, so I shouldn't say we, but what we can all do as a human race is look at the mistakes we make and try not to let them happen over and over again. And that's what the aviation industry has done so well. That's why they're so safe now. It's because they see something happen, something goes wrong. Whether a person is hurt or dies is not as important to them as making sure that that same mistake doesn't lead to further harm. So when that woman was tragically killed recently due to the shrapnel hitting the window, right? And she suffered a fatal injury. They immediately worked together as an industry to figure out how to prevent that from ever happening again. The Cuban example is a little different because whoever was in charge of that flight used an old plane that should have been put out of service. And so that's just simply irresponsible aviation practice. When you look at commercial aviation in America, it's high reliability, almost exclusively safe, and has been for years because they learn from errors. And that's what medicine can be doing much better.
And so what's the problem? Because, you know, clearly in nuclear reactors, for example, there's very, very elaborate multi-layers of safety, you know, frequent drills, you know, where they have ersatz meltdowns, you know, that challenge the workers and keep them on their toes. And similarly, in aviation, of course, there are many, many checks and cross-checks, and there are redundant computer systems that help keep things running smoothly. But I got to say that especially during my training, which was, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, we were really freewheeling it. You know, when it comes to checks, yeah, you know, we had some manual checklists if we really adhered to them. But you know, there seems to be such a gap for medicine.
I think it all comes down to what you mentioned, which is training. I mean, you can look at other industries beyond aviation. Like you mentioned, nuclear. You can look at military, where one small mistake can lead to innocent lives being lost. And these are industries that are very reliable, even if mistakes do occur on occasion. And the reason why they have gotten to that level is not because the systems are perfect. It's because the humans who operate those systems are trained to understand and identify errors before they have the ability to cause harm. And that's not really what happens in medicine, at least not across the board. Again, I didn't study medicine, but it seems like through our research, there isn't really an emphasis on training before you touch the patient. And a lot of the training that doctors get is in the course of actually taking care of human lives.
I got to interject here because, you know, we had a sort of esprit de corps, you know, sort of a grim humor that kind of kept us sane during our training. And one of our mottos during our training was, and I kid you not, I mean, it sounds horrible when you share this with patients, but, you know, this was our common parlance in those days. See one, do one, kill one. And the idea being is, you know, that's how you learn procedures. You know, you observed once, then they said, okay, kid, you know, usually a 22-year-old intern, try putting this chest tube in, and, you know, the inevitable, okay, well, you know, training, you got it wrong, but, you know, you'll be a better doctor for it, ultimately. It's part of the training regimen. Black humor, call it, but, you know, there's some truth to it.
Well, absolutely, and I think most people understand that the best way to learn is to make mistakes, and that kind of goes across all facets of life. We learn from failure. The problem is that medicine has been around for long enough that in most cases, those failures have already happened, and it could be adapted to prevent them from happening again. Now, whether or not an individual has not made that error shouldn't be the point, right? The point should be that if in the course of training, hospital A sees something happen and understands how it happened, they should be training the next generation of doctors using that example to prevent it from happening again. And so what we see today and what we kind of explore a bit in the film is that burden tends to be put on the patient. It's up to the patient to figure out how to address what happened to them and prevent it from happening to other people. And that's what Sue Sheridan, the human interest piece of our film, has done with her career to great success.
And, you know, tell us about Sue Sheridan's crusade. What makes her kind of a central figure in your documentary?
Well, a brief background on her situation is that she experienced two events. And she herself actually did not. Her son, Cal, who was born 23 years ago, had jaundice as an infant, as many do. But the communication between the hospital staff, the nurses, and her was very poor in addressing the severity of that jaundice and its eventual kernicterus, which is the disease that can lead to cerebral palsy when gone unchecked. And so they sent her
home. It's
almost
a medieval disease. I mean, it's, yes, okay, they didn't really know what to do about it prior to the modern era, but it's so remediable. It can be identified and remediated, and the outcome is fine.
Yeah, and actually many of the methods used today are due to her efforts in the early 2000s to help kind of get across the board a way of preventing it from getting worse at that critical one-week mark. So Cal, her son, has cerebral palsy. His story is very inspiring. He's made an amazing, positive life for himself through comedy, and we try and tap into that a bit in the film. Mm-hmm. But a few years after that incident, her husband, Pat, had a tumor in the back of his neck and went in to get it checked out. They did the biopsy. They did everything. They reported back to her that it was benign, and when the double-checking of those reports came back to say it was malignant, that information never got to her. And you know, whether that was an issue with the faxes or whether it was simply an oversight is not necessarily as important as the understanding that, well, 6 months later he woke up basically paralyzed, and that's when they realized that he was dying. To lose 6 months of treatment because of a very simple mistake is the kind of thing that just shouldn't happen. And And without getting too far into how we can fix that, I think her story is very empowering because of the journey she took after those two incidents. Many would be filled with rage, would sue and walk away. And yes, there was litigation, but in her litigation, she made it a point to not allow the information to be suppressed, to make sure it's publicly available so that she can then continue to share that with other hospitals and other healthcare providers to make sure it doesn't happen to anyone else. Now, she is she changes positions frequently, but right now she is at a high level of leadership at the society to improve diagnosis in healthcare. And so she has a national, if not global, role in speaking on behalf of patients and allowing patients to have a voice in this conversation about improving patient safety. We see a lot of people like her, a lot of people who've experienced a tragic event, who have taken that experience and turned it into something positive and empowering. And to us, that's a much more compelling story to tell in a film than to just show six or seven events that happen and scare the hell out of people and walk away like, well, good luck.
Exactly. I mean, the film is not about, not merely horror stories. It does include some really poignant examples of medical mayhem, but it emphasizes suggestions for positive solutions. Now, you keep reiterating that you're not a physician, but you have a pretty good pedigree. You are the son of the late patient safety pioneer, Dr. John M. Eisenberg. Was that part of what inspired you to create this documentary?
Yeah, I kind of buried the lead, I guess, a bit on that, but it's definitely a huge part of why we were inspired to take this this journey, because making a documentary, there are many ways to do it, but the way we approached it was a 3-year journey, a 3-year process of interviews and traveling all over the country and finding people who were willing to tell us about this issue and explore it in a way that we could then reiterate for those who don't maybe know about it. And when I look back at my father's career, he passed when I was 17 years old. Now, a 17-year-old kid doesn't necessarily usually have much interest in medicine and in health policy. I certainly didn't. And I was I wasn't informed about all the work he had done. And over the last 10 to 15 years, I've come across people and seen stories and heard them about the impact he had on them as a mentor and as a colleague. And it was always so amazing to hear. And as we started to think about what film we might do next, we thought, okay, well, AHRQ, the agency that he ran, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, is always year after year facing a budget crisis. Then they may get defunded. They may not get any funding from the government.
In fact, they have some incredibly low percentage of the national healthcare expenditures. So I think it was a very tiny fraction.
Yeah, they are 0.002% or something of the actual expenditures. So their responsibility is to make sure the other 99.99% is actual good quality healthcare.
Wow.
And for some perspective, their budget is typically in the mid 400 millions. Mm-hmm. So the healthcare industry is $3 trillion a year. Yep. And, one of the big responsibilities they have is quality of healthcare and patient safety work. So we started off 3 years ago looking at AHRQ. What's their role? Who are they? What do they do? Why don't most people know about it? And as we interviewed the people who were running AHRQ or had been a part of the leadership there when my dad was there, we realized there's this story about patient safety. And it was a huge passion of my father's. So to take on the responsibility of continuing his legacy, continuing his passion about patient safety and updating it by today's standards and using the skill sets that I have, which is not, a medical degree, which is not experience in medicine, but experience as a storyteller and an outside perspective, to say, okay, well, where are we in patient safety? What does it mean to have quality healthcare in this country, and who is responsible for it in the first place? So that is, in a nutshell, kind of a big nutshell, why we took on this project and why we feel passionate about continuing to be advocates for it and not just say, oh, here's a DVD, hope you like it.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this message with you. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density to ensure your future bone health. It's Osteothera plus Ipraflavone from Claire Labs. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone helps inhibit bone resorption and promotes new bone formation. The Osteothera plus Ipraflavone formulation is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. I believe in Osteothera plus Ipraflavone so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, and I recommend it to my patients. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus Ipraflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Mike Eisenberg. And you actually envision a role for the patient as part of the care team in pointing out perhaps that there's something amiss, that there's an anomaly, that somebody who's coming to examine them, have you washed your hands? What's going into my IV bag? Make sure you're going to operate on the correct side of my body, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Without making patients completely fearful and paranoid as they enter the hospital environment, or seeming like, quote, difficult patients, how can they implement that?
Well, I think we all agree that it shouldn't be the patient's responsibility to get good quality health care. But it is kind of where we're at right now. And in order for the care that patients receive to be what they want as a patient and what they deserve in terms of quality, there is a role for them to play. Now, that doesn't mean patients should be going on WebMD before they go to the doctor and have their own diagnosis only to see if it's confirmed. What we're talking about is when you go to the hospital or you go to any sort of care facility, there should be sinks visible, methods of washing your hands as a clinician within eyesight of that patient so that you're not going from patient to patient to patient, doorknob to doorknob, clipboard to clipboard, and just sharing germs and diseases and infectious potential diseases across the continuum of care. That is the big version of it, right? Let's all understand that hand washing is very, very poorly adhered to in medicine. Mm-hmm.
That's a paradigm that was developed by this fellow Ignaz Semmelweis in the 1800s. Of course, they thought he was a madman, and he ended up being subject to derision and dying in, complete poverty because of his iconoclastic views. Turned out he was right.
And I think that's what we see a lot of times with people who are forward-thinking, is they're usually at first seen as crazy or misinformed. And a lot of times it takes a whole mess to understand the value of these ideas. So where we're at today is that medicine is still kind of in the wrong era of accepting its imperfections and finding solutions to prevent those. And so that's why we call on the patients in some way in the film to help guide themselves along this process. Look out for hand washing. Make sure that you can see them washing their hands. Look out for the medicine that you receive and the charts that are in your room. Make sure that the information is correct to the best of your ability. If they say they're going to give you medication X, make sure it says that on the document. And beyond that, it's very important to have someone with you when you go to the hospital.
I was going to say, have a patient advocate, because sometimes you're out of it and you can't be your own best advocate.
Exactly. And look, I'm 33 years old. I am part of that generation that typically feels we know enough and we are pretty tough. We can handle it. I don't need someone to come with me to the hospital. I can drive myself even if I'm dizzy and nauseous.
Right.
I'll just go if I don't even want to go to the hospital, frankly, because it costs too much money. right? All these factors that are changing the way that patients experience medicine. And throughout all that, it's very important to reiterate to people that you can't do it alone. Doctors can't do it alone, and patients can't do it alone. And we all have to work as a team. And the only way we will be able to work as a team in medicine to achieve like high quality, really good healthcare is if both sides accept that. And that's why asking your doctor if they've washed their hands is probably going to be the hardest thing for patients to ever take on. I made this film, and I still don't feel comfortable asking a doctor if they've washed their hands.
Yeah.
That's not because of some systemic flaw. That's just human nature.
Yeah.
But as soon as we, kind of lower the pedestal a little bit, we should never disrespect our healthcare professionals. We should never assume that they are out to get us or trying to make our lives miserable. Most every one of them is doing the best they can. But if we don't see ourselves as unwelcome voices in that room, as patients, the doctors will actually do a better job.
Indeed. Well, great. You've laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two. We're going to do a deeper dive on some of the things that we can do to improve the quality of medicine and to help to avoid the terrible toll of as many as 440,000 preventable deaths every year, making it the third leading cause of death in the United States behind just heart disease and cancer. The documentary is "To Air is Human." And by the way, that comes from a Latinism, and the quote is actually a little more complete than that. "To air is human," that's kind of a meme. That comes from the Latin. "To err is human, but to persist in error is diabolical." So that's what your documentary is all about. And just briefly before we sign off for part one, how can people access the documentary? We'll repeat it, of course, in part two.
Well, the film is going to be released in the for general audiences in the fall. So it'll probably start on iTunes and then roll out to Hulu and streaming platforms shortly thereafter. Until then, we are taking the film on a tour of sorts. We're going to hospitals and universities and organizations, conferences all over the country, some international, to make sure that those in healthcare can see the film and start acting on it before we put it in the hands of the general public and see if they're willing to act on it.
So if, say, someone's part of a hospital group or organization or a group medical practice, can they talk to your publicist and get arrange for a showing at their facility?
Yep. Well, I am our publicist right now as well. So
okay,
you're
a one man band. You produced, directed, and wrote it.
I have to give credit to my two co-producers though, Matt and Kaylee. The three of us really did this film together. We are a production company, and we work on all these projects as a unit. Mm-hmm. But when somebody is interested in screening the film for their community or their colleagues, what they can do is go to our website, www.toairishumanfilm.com, and there's a booking sheet right there. You can see where we're screening and where we will be screening, and you can also fill out a form that connects you directly to me, and we can talk about how to bring the film to you so that we can have a great discussion after watching the film and start making a difference.
Oh, absolutely. I wish I'd seen the film during my medical school. This is a must for every one of the hundreds of medical schools across the country, and certainly, nursing schools and other related professions. All right, we're going to break for a pause, and when we return, more on the subject of medical mistakes, the documentary "To Air is Human." My guest, the producer, writer, director, Mike Eisenberg. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.